Good day, and welcome to Holland Village. Today's date is 8/30/2002. Today's session title is What Are Ways That Work for Peace in the Middle East? Ways U.S. Christians Can Advocate for Just Peace in Israel and Palestine. Your presenter will be Ann Hofton. You can find this in Holden Village Library or order it under HA 2002-05. Let's listen in.
Ways that work for peace in the Middle East, and Steve can start media ministry going now. My name is Ann Hofton. I'm coordinator for Middle East Networking for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Division for Global Mission. I was hired in May to work part-time helping congregations get access to the resources, the networks, the web pages, the speakers, the folks on the ground, and reports from the Middle East that will help them educate, inform, and bring their congregations into a setting of prayer, of informed advocacy on behalf of peace. It's kind of a tall order on a half-time job, wouldn't you say? But I'm very very challenged and very excited about my new work. I've been speaking this week. I realize it's a bunch of you came in today. I've been speaking about the background to the struggle for peace in the Middle East among Israel and the Palestinians. Some of the difficulties with the peace process, some background to the church in the Christian church, and particularly the Lutherans in the Middle East. And now we're at the point of the kind of the action point. As I was meeting with my colleagues a few weeks ago and we were talking this through how to make this work, I found myself writing in my notes to myself. Sometimes I think better when I can see it. I found myself writing, help them to know, help them to care, help them to act. And that, now we're right kind of at that act point. So if you missed those earlier sessions, go ahead and ask questions of me later after Vespers or something. I'll be glad to help fill you in or give you any of my many previous handouts.
Or we can listen to the tapes.
And listen to the tapes, which are available in the bookstore. Also my recommended books. So this session is about advocacy, what we can do to help bring about peace, what, if anything. It's nice to think that we can do something, and there are some things that we can do. And I've indebted to a lot of people who I work with who've contributed to some of these ideas. The first thing is something that you're doing right now, educating yourself. If you can inform yourself, your family, your friends, and members of your congregation as much as possible about this event, you'll be way ahead of most Americans. The more informed you can be, the better equipped you are to work with others or to teach if you have the opportunity, or just to correct stereotypes when you hear them, to correct misunderstandings or myths. Or language, when you hear people using a stereotype about Jews or about Palestinians or about terrorists, you can step in and say, you know, let me tell you something I've learned about that. So that's the first thing you can do, and it's something that I, in my new job, really hope that you will bring to your congregation as a point of a starting point. There are many, many, many resources that I'm not going to go into now, but if you're a member of an ELCA congregation, our website is rich with resources. If you're a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, your best point of access for information about the Middle East is the Wheatridge Foundation. LCMS is linked to Wheatridge for support of the International Center in Bethlehem. If you're a member of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada, the Church in Canada is a member of the Lutheran World Federation, which has a very active ministry in Jerusalem and in the West Bank. You can go to your church or to the Lutheran World Federation webpage for lots of good help. If you're not a Lutheran, there's also an ecumenical advocacy group in which the ELCA participates called Churches for Middle East Peace. And they are a very strong partner of ours on Capitol Hill and in providing resources for folks on these issues. Churches for Middle East Peace. And I put their website up here. So under the heading of inform yourselves and educate yourselves, I'm going to give you a chance to have just about the best map I found of Palestine and the West Bank. You can just pass that all the way around. And I'll put in a plug right at the outset for my own work, which in part involves a new listserv out of the ELCA and a new website there out of the Division for Global Mission that you can sign up to if you are on the internet, if you have an email system. Part of my job is to provide for congregations and individuals regular bulletins from missionaries, from our church partners in the Middle East, in Jerusalem, from our ecumenical partners, and advocacy alerts and information on how to be involved. I'm going to send this sheet around, which tells you how to join up on that listserv. If you want to do some classes or some teaching or encourage your pastor or education leaders in your congregation to do some of the kind of classes I'm going to be doing next week at St. Matthew's Church in Beaverton, Oregon, there are a couple of resources out of the Division for Global Mission. One is this lovely packet that's just full of information all about not only the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jerusalem, but the people and culture of Palestine. It even has little craft things you can do. And this packet is available free through the Division for Global Mission, ELCA. And there are also some bulletin inserts, very informative, that are camera ready to copy for your church newsletters or bulletins. And these are also available through the ELCA Hunger Program. I have a few of them, and you're welcome to take one if you like. And I also have up here, which I'm not going to pass around, a pretty thorough bibliography. If you don't think you can read all these books, here's an idea. Bring this to your church librarian and see if you can get some of these books into your church library. Because these will be helpful to you and your education leadership in your congregation. So grab one of these if you want to on the way out. And since this is my last presentation here, I'm just going to throw all my handouts your way. And at the end of this session, if there's anything in there that you really don't want, you're just going to throw in the landfill, just throw it back on here, and I'll take it with me to Portland. We don't need to contribute to Holden's solid waste problems. But I do want to get these into your hands as much as possible. Another good resource that's going to be coming out in just a little while is the Holden Village newspaper. You should all receive a copy, having been registered guests here, and that will have quite a thorough center section, all focusing on the emphasis Holden Village has put on Middle East peace this summer, with some articles by people who have been our speakers over the course of this summer. So I urge you to watch for that, and again, get that into the hands of your education folks at church or your pastor, whoever provides the most leadership on adult education. Okay, the next step, I think, for folks who are ready to undertake some advocacy or interested in knowing where to take a stand, is to know where their church stands. My research didn't yield much in the other Lutheran churches, but the ELCA and its ecumenical partners have quite clear positions on many Middle East policies, and you, for the most part, only have to go to their web pages to get them. I met with a lot of grassroots folks from different churches in Washington in May, and I was startled at how some of the most effective grassroots organizing people that we have didn't know where their own church had taken a stand. And to me, I guess maybe I'm just a bureaucrat, but that's my starting point, is where has my church already taken a stand? What has our church council already said? Or what letters or statements has our bishop already issued? We have a really good, in the ELCA, we have a good track record on a lot of the issues that are the crucial ones in the Middle East. And I just want to let you know where some of those positions are. And again, if you're not ELCA, check with your own church and see where that you stand on these. The ELCA very clearly supports a two-state solution along the lines of the Land for Peace idea. They are in favor of security for the state of Israel and a state with secure boundaries for the Palestinian people. They're on the record that way. And if you're interested enough to go through this, the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs in Washington has a very thorough documentation of every single assembly action and every single letter from a bishop that speaks to these issues, and it's all documented, but this is way too many pages to photocopy for everybody. That's why I just thought I'd hit the highlights. The ELCA also stands for a freeze on Israeli settlements, and strongly points to that as the way toward a viable Palestinian state. And if you look at the map that I passed out of the West Bank and Palestine, this is a little bit of a throwback to a session I did a couple nights ago, but you can see how fragmented the West Bank is by the settlements, the intervening throughway roads that have been built by the Israelis, and the borders, which are all, this is the essence of the Camp David 2 agreement that kind of went down the drain now, but this is where the last place where negotiations stood was at this map. You can see that these little clumps of real estate in dark purple that represent the Palestinian-controlled areas don't resemble a nation-state in any way with the integrity of a contiguous border or any way to transit from one area to another. So where churches, I think, have to do some work, this is my own opinion, is on the issue of withdrawal from settlements. We haven't made a statement that's very clear on that. We're very clear in the ELCA on freezing the building of settlements, including what they call the widening or thickening, the building out of existing settlements to create larger settlement blocks. Because our statements clearly point to that as a barricade to a viable Palestinian state in the future. Okay, on the issue of aid, military and other aid, our ELCA ties aid to Israel directly to willingness to negotiate. We have said that we would withhold aid unless Israel demonstrates consistent willingness to negotiate. That's been very up and down, and so consequently aid has just continued. But that's
when you say that's been up and down, what do you mean?
Well, I mean negotiations. Israel's willingness to negotiate has gone up and down, depending on who's in power there. So it kind of ebbs and flows. But U.S. aid just continues. So what the ELCA has said is that we would tie continued U.S. aid to willingness to negotiate a real settlement, a real agreement. Our ELCA peace statement for peace in God's world ties aid to promotion of human rights, building of self-reliance. Those are the ways that we, in our ELCA peace statement, conditionalize aid, is that it promote human rights and support self-reliance. Also, our church has stated that we would support transferring military aid to humanitarian aid. Okay, on violence, yeah.
Coming back to the two-state solution, in the video that we were watching tonight, the Episcopal and the Anglican bishop and priest seemed to be talking about a one-state solution. They were saying that they would be one state, that would be like a modern democracy with everybody living together.
Yeah.
Is that a formal statement of the Episcopal Church or Anglican Church?
I can't speak for the Episcopal Church, but that's something a lot of people talk about. A lot of Palestinians dream about, including some Lutheran Palestinians I know, who've gone on the record to say so. But I think it's a non-starter, personally, because the demographics of Israel cannot be allowed to change in such a way that they would incorporate the entire Palestinian population of the West Bank. That would throw off Israeli demographics. They wouldn't have a Jewish state anymore. So it's a pipe dream. It's a beautiful pipe dream, but I don't think politically it's a go. And it's not the position of the ELCA or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jerusalem.
You know, another...
Sure, go ahead.
Tying aid to negotiations, the idea sounds great because we want that outcome. But negotiations require two sides coming together.
Mm-hmm.
And when we've had the suicide bombings and the things that Israel is going through right now, and when you look at the geographical location of Israel and where they are, it seems to me that it's a very difficult situation. I mean, this is not a piece of cake, because what do you do? We know what we did after 9/11. And what does Israel do? With Arafat, does he want to negotiate? I mean, I haven't been to any of the meetings, so I'm coming on board late.
No, that's
so
okay.
That's all been covered, so I will be quiet on that. But I think that's a very difficult situation when you want to negotiate. Everybody wants peace.
Well, that's something we talked about. Not everybody wants peace.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But for those who do, it's an extremely... you've identified the geography is a really big part of this problem, which is why we spent a whole session on it. But and because the Israel is darn hard to defend, but they do have probably the second greatest military force in the world, and that's not solving the problem either. Where the ELCA stands is, in its language, is pretty general. It says, to relate U.S. foreign assistance to the willingness of those nations, that is Israel and the Palestinians, to negotiate with one another in good faith and to adhere to international law and human rights conventions. Now, we already know that Israel is in defiance of both U.N. Security Council resolutions and human rights conventions, but... let's say we got there, then the ELCA would say, okay, fine, we can continue aid.
Got a real quick one.
Mm-hmm.
When did the ELCA announce or promote the No New Settlements approach, and how many settlements have been, do you have any idea how many settlements have been built since the ELCA policy, which would imply that we should,
tricky,
in fact, one of the ones that have been built since we had our No New Settlement policy to be vacated?
Mm-hmm. Our most recent statement was in October 2001.
Okay.
That was in a letter from from Bishop Anderson to President Bush. But since we first said that, how many settlements have been built? Oh, I don't know. That's a tricky one. Let me count it up and see if I can come back to you on that.
I don't need an exact number.
Yeah.
I don't even need any number, but the idea was how long the Lutherans been saying this sort of thing and being ignored.
Yeah, how impotent are we?
Probably.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I have a quick question.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And it's maybe not a simple answer, but we're talking about, and I thought this session was advertised, ways that make peace work, or something of that variety. Have we defined at all what we think peace is? What does it look like? So that we have some idea of what's the objective of all of these various actions you're suggesting that we take. That's question number one.
I would say, if by we you mean the Holden community, or this group, or the folks who have been gathered here.
I was thinking maybe to say the ELCA. Well, I mean, we're gathering to talk about a subject, but, which I think to get some perspective, particularly to say the ELCA, this is the position, we're really talking about a group of people who have taken a position and written something down, and yet we're saying that the entire membership of the Lutheran Church needs education as to what's going on, okay? So maybe it doesn't represent the entire Lutheran Church.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole issue about whether representative governance works in the ELCA. What I was saying is that the cornerstone for what we understand peace to take to get to peace is a two-state solution with a state security for Israel and a state for the Palestinians. That's the simplest answer to our. Then there are these other things about.
Okay, so if you have two states, are they warring?
No. Thank you. They're not. They're at peace. I should have been more clear.
What about yours?
Well, what about, you know... The reason I'm asking this question is I attended three nights ago, another session, and I did, on the trail, spend a lot of time thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And something came to mind, which was the history of what happened after World War II with Japan and what the occupying forces did with Japan in order to try to change the culture from an imperialistic warring culture to a different one today. And in light of what seems to be going on in the culture where generation after generation is being educated in hating the opposing part. And it's going on in Ireland as well. And so when you say, how do you make peace work in that environment?
You pose a good question. Anyone else want to comment on it?
One thing that we've learned in the discussion.
I can just answer.
One of the things I've heard us talking about in this discussions and just from my own experience working with the poor is that yes, some of what you say is true, that people are being maybe taught hatred, but I think a lot of it, they learn it because they're forced into these refugee camps.
One reinforces the other. I mean,
the violence breeds violence, and so, you know, when you've had four generations in refugee camps, it's going to be violent, whether they're taught that or not. These kids are going to start rebelling, you know.
Yeah, you remove the injustice. That's how you get to peace. You remove the injustice.
And I think that's why there's revolutions everywhere, because after a while people just can't take anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jerusalem states very clearly that what they are after is a just peace. And they always put just before peace. So they've already sacrificed a lot. And it's like a little bit like a, it's draining away. The land is just draining away like sand between their fingers. So they really seek a just solution and attach peace and justice together.
But on the other hand, my question too is, because I have a Jewish friend and he says that, no, you can't talk to Arafat. Because, like you said, there are some people that just don't want peace either, and so it seems like we're stuck.
Yeah, we have a great vacuum of leadership. It's part of what makes this situation a little chaotic, because the leadership are not helpful on either side at this point. So.
And it's the people that suffer.
And yet the people on the ground in both cultures desperately want peace. It's, you know.
Arafat, I think, though, has a really difficult position in defense of him. I know few are willing to do that, but I think, on the one hand, if he goes too far to the right, he's going to have Hamas, or to peacemaking, he's going to have Hamas after him, and if he goes too far the other way, to work with the left and the Palestinians, the Israelis are going to kill him. He's got it from both sides. He doesn't have much room to move. Or anybody who's a leader. I shouldn't just say Arafat. It's difficult to be a leader, too.
Mm-hmm. Has there been a Palestinian state in existence at any time in this period?
No. That's one of the tricky things about making human rights conventions apply, because they all apply to states operating among themselves.
It's my impression there never was a Palestinian state.
There was a land called Palestine that was administered by the British, and before that by the Turks. But that ceased to have meaning long, and especially in 1948.
Well, that was in part of Jordan, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, 2/3 of it went over and became Jordan. Let me go on, if I can, and cover a little bit more of this, and then we can pick up, I'm sure these same things will come back. I want to be clear that where the ELCA stands is for an end to violence, for ceasefires on both sides, for humanitarian law, as we understand it, and human rights, as the international community has defined it, for an international peacekeeping presence. And this is something that we are... I'm referencing in an action that was released just the day before I came here. So I only have one copy of this thing, but anyway, it's another plea for international peacekeeping presence, for withdrawal of Israel from the occupied territories, and for an end to occupation. An end to the occupation of what Israel calls administration in the West Bank and Gaza. You asked about Jerusalem. We have a statement called Toward a Shared Jerusalem, I think. And it calls for Jerusalem to be an open city that is shared by all three of the faiths that claim it as holy. It doesn't address so much the political governance of Jerusalem, which is a big problem, but it does say clearly that states what hadn't been stated up until that time, about 6 years ago, that Jerusalem is extremely significant to Christians as well as to Jews and to Muslims. So that some Christian leaders in the region issued a statement that the ELCA joined in on. It seeks the political rights of all the Israelis and Palestinians that live in the city, that they all have their rights be respected, and that the religious rights of all three faiths be respected. This is not a clear political stance on Jerusalem from our church, but it's a way of talking about Christian presence in that holy city. The settlements and their increase. This is a little bit like what I said before. The closest thing we have to an ELCA statement on settlements is that the U.S. must do what the U.S. should do what it has to bring settlement activity to a close. They've really gone only as far as saying cease building of new settlements. They haven't said anything about withdrawal from settlements or who might get those settlements if that withdrawal were to occur. That's a whole another an interesting discussion. And finally, the ELCA has gone very strongly in the direction that the church in Jerusalem has asked us to do, and that is prayer. It's such a basic thing that we shouldn't have to ask, should we? But the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jerusalem has asked us very plainly for prayer for them, for their people, and for peace among both Israelis and Palestinians, Muslims, Christians, and Jews. And so in response, the ELCA has joined with some other churches to establish a ecumenical prayer vigil. And I'll give you a handout about that. This is something you can join as an individual or as a congregation. Many of our congregations have joined. You can send a letter or call or use the web. If you go to www.loga.org, that's the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs, and the prayer vigil is housed there. It is not solely a Lutheran effort, it's an ecumenical effort, but Lutherans have kind of been leading the way on this. The way it's organized is that each state has a date of the month assigned to it. And Texas, for example, is the 14th of each month. So we covenant among ourselves as a congregation or a adult Bible study or a youth group or a family that on the 14th we will pray for peace, the coming of peace for the people of the Middle East. And if you go to the webpage, you can join up formally and click on. And of course, we hope you'll do that because then we can sort of tally it up, and it's just cooler that way. But you can just look at this little chart in the back and see where your state falls. And know that on that date or on the adjacent Sunday, maybe the Sunday just after or before that date, lots of other people are with you in prayer. I don't know about you, but I love that feeling of being surrounded by others who are praying, not because our prayers mean more because we've got a bigger tally, but just because it's a community. It feels like we're together in that. And it feels empowering and helpful because that's what they've asked for. And it's a simple thing. We also know that the folks in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan are praying for us. And they say so all the time, which is a great thing to know. I liked the rationale behind some of this prayer vigil idea. One was that God's grace is the source of all peace, not our machinations. And that the prayer vigil provides an opportunity for congregations to bring people and concerns together in lots of ways, in education, learning settings, and in worship, and in advocacy. So that's a big part of what our church is doing. Now, my time is speeding along here. Another way to help is a new program out of the World Council of Churches called the Ecumenical Accompaniment Program. It's a pretty ambitious program, and the ELCA and Churches for Middle East Peace both are encouraging this program and providing some money for it. And it comes out of what has been proven that where Westerners, Europeans, Scandinavians, Americans are present, violence is less. Situations are diffused that might otherwise become violent. People are protected who might otherwise be injured or killed. And based on that and some of the success of other programs like Witness for Peace in Central America, this program seeks to provide an opportunity for folks to go into the Middle East, into the West Bank, and stay and live there among the people for the projected goal is about 3 months. So that's why I say it's ambitious. I mean, you have to be able to afford to do it, you have to have the time off, and you have to pay your own way. But maybe insurance is the way. I know they provide training, and they're providing training in nonviolence and lots of background to help people feel that this is something that they can do. So we're seeking gifts to support this, and people, warm bodies, people who will go and become part of the community. And then one of the models is the fine, I think it's Mennonite groups called Christian Peacemaker Teams, who have really set the bar high in their witness in Hebron mostly. This is just getting off the ground. It was launched this summer. The first group is supposed to be going in August or has gone, made up, I think, of all Scandinavians. And I think they had 16 or so people who taking part in the first of these accompaniment teams. So if this is something that interests you, I'll tell you how to get in touch with the program. And anyway, I'll be telling about it in my listserv if you want to get those. Yes, sir.
And the formula for a Palestinian state seemed to me like for every, let's say, for every acre that they give for a Palestinian state in the West Bank, that Jordan ought to match that. Jordan and maybe even possibly Egypt, so that show a good faith that everybody around there is in favor of the Palestinian state.
You mean actual real estate?
Yeah.
Yeah, since 2/3 of the Palestinian so-called state was in Jordan.
That would get us the contiguous borders we need, or the
Well, Jordan's just on the other side of the Jordan River.
Oh, well, that's an interesting proposal.
What was the proposal?
Oh, that, well, let me see if I interpret it correctly, that for each parcel that Israel provides, but of course there you base the assumption on the fact that Israel's actually giving something to people rather than having them already have something taken away from them. So there's a
way to settlement.
And then that that Jordan and Egypt pitch in as a good faith Arab effort. Give some more real estate.
Can you talk about an alternative to that, about the Saudi proposal?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting proposal from, it's actually, well, okay, Prince Abdullah from Saudi Arabia has proposed a new kind of quickie peace formula that is land for peace, that says Israel can be recognized by the Arab states and be secure, and the conflict with the Palestinians will cease if it leaves the West Bank. And is that how it works? Return to 67 boundaries, basically. And then the trade-off is the conflict will stop.
Is in trade for full peace from all the Arab states.
Yeah, and all the Arab states mostly have signed on to it now in that meeting in Lebanon.
What's different about that is the recognition of Israel. Is that what's different?
Recognition of Israel and assurance of no hostilities.
But they don't want to give up Israel with the West Bank.
But, so, let me continue. So this solution, is that what you're talking about, Barb?
Yeah, that would just be,
what he doesn't address, is what I think this gentleman is getting to, is the settlements. He doesn't address the existing residents in the West Bank who are Israeli and all their infrastructure that's been designed to support those settlements that take up so much of the West Bank have resulted in so much confiscation of land. Now the one solution that an Israeli academic put forth a couple of weeks ago, which is kind of interesting, was that they the King Prince Abdullah pay all those settlers an equivalent subsidy to the government when they got to move into the West Bank, pay them all to move back to Israel and get apartments. Because many of the settlers, they're called, the folks who live in commuting distance to Tel Aviv in these new townhouses, cannot really afford to. Who's going to buy their townhouse, right? And where are they going to move to? They move to the West Bank with a big government subsidy. So that's a big problem with the settlements, but I thought that was kind of a unique...
But they moved there for political reasons anyway.
Most don't. Honestly, fewer than 23% have a strong political or religious fervor about it. The majority moved there because they could get a cheaper home with the subsidy, and it's crowded in Israel. So... But that's a kind of a cool idea. King Abdullah could then, you know, buy all those people new apartments in Israel, and then the settlements would be empty, and all the Palestinians could move into them.
Well, this wall that's being built, where is that? This wall that's being built?
Well, it'll take them about 40 years to build that wall, but they're working on it.
Where does it go?
Right down the green line, right down the wall.
They're incorporating a lot of the settlements into the part of Israel.
Oh, yeah. Well, all right, yeah, you're right. Probably. I don't know much about that wall, I got to tell you. That's probably outside of my...
Is that really true?
Yeah, it was a political maneuver to start building it and say, you know, look, we're going to protect you, don't worry. We'll build a big wall. But the more devastating barriers at present, I mean, it takes a long time to build another Berlin Wall, but... They have these great deep ditches that they build, you know, incredible amounts of concertina wire, and these big holes that are so you can't drive through because they're just giant trenches. And so,
who is they? When you say
the Israelis, the Israeli government and military administration. I have about 20 minutes left, and I want to say something about looking at the media. Is that okay? I'm a journalist and trained in journalism, and it's always a struggle to figure out what's going on in the media, in the newspaper, on CNN, and NPR, whatever you hear. There are some folks that can help, but I think the most simply put way of saying, look hard at the media. And I know you know this pertains to not just this issue, but lots of other issues as well. But this issue in particular has manifested a fairly obvious bias sometimes in our U.S. media. One way of looking at it is in the kind of the anecdotal. If you see a picture of a family grieving, and you see them, the New York Times ran a full page pictorial of grieving families following one of the suicide bombings. And everyone here agrees, I think, that that kind of violence is completely out of the, beyond the pale. No one here supports that. And it's a big news story, and it makes a lot of pictures, but you don't see a spread like that that shows the suffering on the Palestinian side, in my view. It's.
You think that's because of AIPAC?
I think it's because the U.S. has a strategic relationship with Israel. And I'll be very clear about this as my opinion as a trained journalist. I don't think it's solely because of Jewish pressure. I don't think it's because we love Israel more or are better buddies with them as a culture, or the journalists like Israel better. It's The U.S. has a strategic relationship with Israel. They are our ally. And you will find that throughout international coverage, foreign affairs coverage, our allies get a different kind of coverage than folks we are not allies. And we are strategically allied with Israel. They are on our team. And this is reflected in the media. They know better. I went to a conference in April in New York with journalists from Israel, from Palestine, from the U.S. And everyone says they know better. Still it happens. And they will send the blame up. Oh, it's my editor or the guy who writes the headlines. But the fact is, it's really up to us as consumers and as people who want to be informed to listen and read just a little more broadly and more closely. Look for the references to a kind of language that's a stereotype. See how the word violence is used. See if the word violence is applied as often to the Israeli military forces as it is to Palestinian terrorists or Palestinian activists. Find alternative sources. I know my dial is on NPR all day long. I don't move it, but I kind of force myself to get to tune to something else. So listen, I need to hear a variety of points of view. I'm grateful for the coverage of the BBC, for example, that I hear on radio. It's a whole different slant to things. In the last year, I've gone to many, many web pages that offer alternative news. Two in particular I point to is, one is a newspaper out of Israel called Haaretz. They have an English language web page, and if you want to know where it is, come and see me. The other is a group called the Alternative Information Center, and they do a lot of picking up news and from other sources that aren't the mainstream dominant culture media that we get out of our TVs and in our newspapers. I wanted to say look for balance and imbalance, but man, balance is getting harder and harder to talk about. So you can do that, but I invite you to look hard for stories of the Palestinian reality, stories of Palestinian life, what it's like. Have you ever seen this map? And see if you can find them. And that's a different way of looking at balance, because balance can be deceiving. But see if you can find those Palestinian stories. Look at the way language is used. And here I want to hold up a piece prepared by Americans for Middle East Understanding. It's called The Link, and I think it's available in the bookstore. If not, I put their webpage. I will put their webpage up here. Americans for Middle East Understanding is a group that the ELCA has as a partner through Church World Service, the National Council of Churches, Church World Service and Witness. They produced a lexicon, a glossary of words used in reporting stories out of the Israel-Palestine conflict. This was really designed as a tool for journalists, and it was put in the hands of folks related to Church World Service or Church Americans for Middle East Understanding. It's on their webpage. And it has great definitions of some of the terms that you hear in the media, and defines them in a way that is helpful, because a lot of journalists, especially those who are not specialists in this area, they just pick up the words that they hear other people using, and they just go with it. And it's not always the right word, and it's not always used the right way. And that's something that if you look at the way news is written or the way you hear it reported, just listen and see, does that sound right to me? I mean, I question some of the anchor guys that I've liked, you know, and been fans of for a long time. And different reporters have come under heat in the course of this last 2 years.
Can you give us an example or two?
you saw me pausing. Linda Gradstein from NPR has come under very severe criticism for her reporting out of Jerusalem. And I, when I first saw it on the alternative information webpage that she was actually, it was being raised that she was biased, I thought, yeah, I knew that. I knew that. I'd been hearing it for a long time. And when one of her, when other folks from NPR or the BBC go to the West Bank or to Jerusalem, they don't cite all Israeli government sources, for example, the way Linda Gradstein does.
So what words would she use that would be contentious?
Well, it's not so much her language as her... I'll leave this out. It's her sources. She rarely goes to the West Bank. She rarely interviews a Palestinian. She will cite... Palestinian leadership are said to be, but then she'll go straight to the Israeli leadership and quote them. So it's always one step away. It seemed that way to me for a long time. And do you have someone else in mind?
Well, I guess I was just thinking maybe you had some specific words, you know, that you could highlight. But
I thought you meant a reporter.
Well. After 9/11,
yeah, go ahead. You've got one. I can tell.
Donald Rumsfeld, under a question from one reporter, said, "Look, I'm not going to tell you the truth. You should just know that that's just how it is." And then he just went on saying what he was saying, you know. Well, when you listen to military figures, whether it's the U.S. military or whether it is the source from the Israeli military. You are not, at first hearing, going to get necessarily the truth about any particular incident. You're going to get something that is intended to stall or delay the revealing of what the actual truth or situation is. And that is just conflict, you know, war, spin management by military officials. It's just exactly how they do it. So, you know, I've learned when I hear crazily, you know, there'll be some incident, somebody in Palestinian is dying. The quote from the Israeli military will always be, they're investigating it. And then by the time that, you know, the truth comes out 2 or 3 days later, you know, it's not news any longer. This has happened many times as I've paid closer attention. That's just one example in news reporting and in, you know, gleaning your information. And I think it's important to realize that I don't know who said it, somebody better than me can maybe this is a famous quote, truth is the first casualty of war.
That's good.
You know, it's true in what we hear from our military and also from the, you know, the Mideast situation.
You wouldn't want it any other way, would you?
Well, you know.
Well, part of what
you cannot have it any other way. But just knowing it might be.
Yeah. It's the word of the day, discernment.
Yeah.
When you get. For one thing, if you're only listening to the headlines, there was, you know, this attack or this, what did you say, investigation, and then it'll never be followed up on except in the back columns. So they take a different approach and read more more deeply, more commentary, or more thorough articles that talk about the whole situation, because no newspaper is going to follow up on those investigations very thoroughly, and you can't find it. That's a discouraging reality. There are two other factors to this. So discernment would be the one. Can you find the truth or just make the effort to look for it? And then if you see a flaw, an error, or a slant in presentation, go ahead and make the correction. Pick up the phone and call the... Most newspapers today have an ombudsman or the reporter, him or herself, and take them on. Lots of times they don't know any more about... They don't know any better. They didn't mean any harm. But you can make a correction that might make a difference next time. And if you really are strong enough to go the next step, write an opinion piece. There aren't enough of them. And if you are able to inform yourself and have a point of view that represents something other than what the mainstream media is putting out there in your town, go ahead and write it. Put your name on it and put the name of your church. That'll go a long way. You'll be surprised how eager they might be to receive something like that.
But won't your local church be mad at you if they don't
see it? They're not speaking for me.
Don't know.
I don't know how it is here, but in Canada, if you put the name of your church in, it doesn't get in.
Oh, really?
Okay, because they don't want that.
All right, then don't do
religion,
that.
Religion, right? You know, you can bring in spirituality, but not really. So, yeah. Just be careful.
There are three actions I want to run through with you on the advocacy side before I run out of time. And I have one more handout about this. My last handout. These are three pending actions that have been... that I've been made aware of by the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs, who's my partner in this networking job, in the last, since July 22. The first is this yellow sheet that you're getting right here that says, write to President Bush about breaking the cycle of violence. It gives five or six tip points, which I didn't want to write all out here. But it uses Bishop Hansen's letter to President Bush, which is just on the back side, as the basis for this action alert. And this is a very, you've got the tool in your hands to write that letter if you want to. The second is something that's been generated more recently since the first part of, or the last part of July. Bishop Munib Younan of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jerusalem, and here's how you spell it, is trying to organize a meeting with President Bush together with other church leaders from Jerusalem, the Anglican and Roman Catholic and Greek Orthodox leaders. And he's kind of been a leader on this, to try to get this this group to meet with President Bush to point out to him that there is a Christian presence in Jerusalem and in Palestine, and that they have a point of view and that they are willing to help. But at this, so far they have basically been disregarded in the whole process. So he is asking for a meeting with President Bush, and he wants to bring Mark Hansen, our ELCA bishop, along too. That's fine. And so far he's been brushed off. They are willing to set him up to meet with somebody from the defense or the State Department, but not President Bush. So he asks us, and he is our partner, for a letter to President Bush urging him to take that meeting with Bishop Younan and Bishop Hansen and the other leaders. That's a simple letter you can write yourself. I don't have a template. And the third is a letter to President Bush regarding the importance of having a international presence because of the humanitarian crisis that's now appearing in the West Bank, where that because of the curfews and the closures, malnutrition is becoming really apparent, especially among children, and health problems. Education is not being able to be delivered. And so this is an effort that was initiated by Churches for Middle East Peace, our partner in Washington. Here's their webpage. I have only one copy of this one. I just didn't seem to get it photocopied today. But this is another effort to try to get an international presence there that would intervene and make humanitarian aid, humanitarian conditions improve in the West Bank. And The last thing I have that we're also participating in is this petition from Churches for Middle East Peace. This is from their webpage, and I haven't used it too much because I've been really promoting this prayer vigil, but here I am at Holden, you know, why not start something? Sometimes things get started at Holden that have a life. Yeah, Karen's smiling. They take on life. This is a petition, a Christian call for peace in the Holy Land. And it uses most of these same points that I've already referenced. The shared Jerusalem, the end to violence. It's quite general, but Churches for Middle East Peace is trying to collect signatures on this petition. So I'll leave this on the table over here, and if it feels right to you, go ahead and sign it. And it's now 7:15. I can take a couple of questions, maybe.
Yeah, I've got a couple of resources, Gary. I want to mention, and then I have a question. Mm-hmm. For those of you who live on the Oregon coast or are from California, Radio Pacifica is a wonderful resource for alternative news, not only about Palestine, but around the world. Also,
they were at that conference I was at Washington, in New York.
The Nation and The Economist often have very interesting articles on this particular subject we're talking about. And my question is, in the circles that you kind of move in, both conversationally and in terms of action, does anyone address the problem of religious fundamentalism, particularly as it relates to Israel and also to Islam? Because we have a Jewish son,
mm-hmm.
and that's a piece that he says is not going to go away. And no matter who's elected as Prime Minister of Israel, they have to deal with that. And it's not a pretty picture.
Yeah. There was a recent alert issued by Churches for Middle East Peace that pointed to a group called Evangelicals for Middle East Understanding or something. I can't quite remember what it's called. They're based out of North Park College in Chicago.
Yeah, it's Evangelicals for Middle East Understanding.
Isn't that it? Evangelicals for Middle East Understanding. And they recently released a very fine statement separating themselves from the kind of fundamentalism that attaches itself to Zionism unquestioningly and promotes Israel uncritically. I don't know how to tell you how to get that right now, but if you
ask. That's a question I'm asking. But in Israel itself, anyone who is in leadership needs to deal with that segment of society that is willing to die and to kill leaders to have a Zionist state.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant American fundamentalists.
No, so my question is, you know, are there any of our representatives in the Near East that are addressing that dilemma for both the Muslim community and Israel? Because, the Al-Aqsa Brigade, as well as Hamas, as well as, mm-hmm. you know, the ultra-Orthodox folks.
I would say from my understanding, our missionaries and our staff people in Jerusalem and Ramallah, who are pretty few, are working really with the Lutherans there, and in such settings of dialogue with, like the Israeli peace folks, and others from the more mainstream or Muslim community. That's what I know of. So you've pointed to a need.
Are there many groups like Open House, which does promote that interaction between mm-hmm. Palestinians and Israelis
There are a lot. And you pointed to Open House, which is a fine one in Ramallah.
They're little. I mean, we want to support them and love them. There are a lot of little agencies and organizations that are trying to bring, for example, children together to camp or to community centers or to peace activities that they can do together. In the Israeli culture today, I'd say those are do not have the high profile that they once had, as the culture, the society is kind of closed in, but they are emerging more and more. An excellent one is this one, the committee, Israel Committee Against Home Demolitions. And they bring Israeli and Palestinian folks together, a little bit like a Habitat for Humanity project, but more radical, to go into settings where homes have been demolished, bulldozed, and build new ones, or put on a demonstration that is clearly Israelis and Palestinians together. So I invite you to pick one of these up. This is a great organization along that line. And before I dismiss you, last chance for one of these pretty posters. These are distributed by the World Council of Churches, and I'd really not like to take all of them home with me, so for a free will offering, you can have one of these posters for your congregation. Thank you so much for coming, and if you have questions, please just follow up with me. All of my email address on that blue sheet. Thank you.
Thank you.